We're getting ready to start the meeting. We do have a quorum. We'll call the roll call in just a second. Please feel free to begin. We have a quorum.
Good morning, and welcome to the Broward County Planning Council regular meeting and public hearing of June 22nd, 2023. Can we ask School Board Member Zeman, please, to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
United States of America,
and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation,
under God, indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so very much. Chair DiGiorgio is on travel. He asked me to chair today's meeting, and we wish him and the others on the phone safe travels, and we'll see you all very, very soon. The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Brian Blackwelder, Mr. Robert Breslow, Mayor Felicia Brunson,
here,
Commissioner Angelo Castillo,
present,
Ms. Denise B. Fernandez, Mayor Michelle J. Gomez,
good morning,
Ms. Ryan Greenberg,
present,
Mayor Rex Hardin,
I'm here via telephone.
Thank you. Mr. Easton K. Harrison. Councilmember Denise Appleby Horland. Mayor Josh Levy.
Here.
Here.
Commissioner Jackie Rayleigh.
Here.
Vice Mayor Nan Rich. Here. Mr. David Rosenoff. Mayor Michael J. Ryan. School.
Present. We didn't hear any present.
Thank you. School Board Member Dr. Alan Zeman.
Last again.
Thank you very much. I have excused absence requests from Mr. Breslow, Ms. Fernandez, and Mr. Rosenoff. Without objection?
So moved.
Thank you very, very much.
Excuse me, Commissioner Castillo, Chair Castillo, sorry. Tommy DiGiorgio is online. She didn't get to him on the list yet, I think.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. DiGiorgio, are you there?
I am here. Thank you, Commissioner Castillo.
And then I didn't know if the council wanted to add Mr. Blackwelder to the excused absence request of Ms. Fernandez, Mr. Rosenoff, and Mr. Breslau.
Without objection. Thank you very, very much. Today's order is going to be moved around a little bit on the agenda in order to accommodate the time constraints of several members who are on the phone. And so, Barbara, I'm going to turn it over to you so that you can take us through the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. I blinked out. Did you take a motion on all of all the consent items or just C4?
All we've done is the excused absences.
Okay,
so
if I could just ask you to consider item C1 and C2. The minutes will be here at your next meeting.
C1 and C2.
Second.
Is there anyone from the public that wants to be heard on items C1 or C2? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Let it reflect that we approve those unanimously. C3. Or do you want to jump around?
Oh, no. C3 is going to be provided at your next meeting. That's
okay.
The summary minutes from the May Planning Council meeting.
What's next?
The next item. So for the regular agenda, what I would ask is that item R1 is the presentation by the school board and its consultant, the school board staff and its consultant, regarding the update of the student generation rate study. I would ask that be moved to after the public hearing agenda.
Okay.
So we could take items R2, R3, and then public hearing items PH1 through PH4, and then we could ask the school board staff to come forward if that is okay with the council.
Without objection. Item R2.
No council report today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. R3.
Hi, good morning again. Thank you. Executive Director's report. I have a couple of action items that I would like to ask for. One is the proposed year 2024 meeting schedules and your backup materials. If I get approval for that, we will post that online for the public and for you all to be able to start calendaring for next year. If I could get an without an objection or motion to approve.
I'll move that.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Any discussion? Any from the public? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
That motion carries unanimously.
Thank you. The second item is just a just an alert. I'll be polling you for the combined November-December meeting date, either November 30th or December 7th. So you'll receive that sometime over the summer, and we can finalize that date at your at a fall meeting.
Thank you.
Also, I would like to just remind you, July 27th is your next meeting date. That is going to be a virtual workshop only. I will send out the Zoom link. It's the same Zoom link you use for every meeting. It will also be webcast to the public. So although there won't be an actual unless someone has their camera on, but it will be available to the public also. And as a reminder, the guest speaker at that workshop will be Dr. Jennifer Hurado. And that is anticipated for a 90-minute time block from 10 o'clock to 11:30 on July 27th.
Okay.
Okay. The next item is additional agenda material. There's additional agenda material that I, one, would like to ask you to accept, one, for this item, and that's a letter from the City of Coral Springs requesting a six-month extension to their recertification. Usually I would put together a memo with this, but I was short on time, and it was important to get this to you before the summer break. I would ask that the council, per your rules, extend the six-month to the City of Coral Springs so that they can address their provisional recertification that was done last year.
Is there a motion on the item?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Any from the public? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? That motion carries unanimously.
Thank you. And that 6 months will actually take us to January next year because of the combined meeting dates. So if they aren't able to meet it by January next year, then they would come in for an additional 6 months that they're permitted by your rules. So thank you.
We all love Coral Springs. Okay, yes. What's next?
The next item is additional agenda material that came in for item PH3, and that was just comments that was provided by the school board staff to be included in the report as it moves forward. So I would accept that. I would ask that you accept that additional agenda material also.
Is there a motion on PH3?
Not on PH3, to accept the item, the comment. Okay.
Yeah, we'll be fine with that. All right.
We accept.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
With that, the final item that I have is just the August 24th date, just making sure that everyone saw their emails that the City of Hollywood Land Use Plan Amendment application will not be a public hearing that day, so you can probably free up your day. I'd ask you to schedule until about 4 o'clock that afternoon. So it should be a regular meeting, 10, you know, I always ask you to block off 10 to noon.
Okay.
Okay. So I just wanted to alert you to that.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the Executive Director's report. We have four items on the public hearing agenda today. Item PH1, we have a speaker signed in for item PH3 only. There are no speakers for items PH1, PH2, or PH4. I do just want to give you a quick glimpse of what each of these items are. Item PH1 is a land use plan amendment in the City of Parkland, and it is to recreation and open space. It's preservation of parkland. Staff wholeheartedly supports the preservation of open space, recommends approval of item PH1. Item PH2 is it's an update of policy, existing policy 2.21.6, in the Broward County Land Use Plan, and it adds the component of the Regional Climate Action Plan for consideration during the review of land use plan amendments and land use changes. The policy already reflects the Climate Change Action Plan that's adopted by Broward County, but they would add the additional layer of the Regional Climate Action Plan that includes Monroe, Miami-Dade, Broward County, and Palm Beach counties as part of that. So that's a proposal that came through, was initiated by the County Commission. There are no speakers signed in on that item. Item PH3 is an incentive policy.
Can we move on items PH1 and 2 real quick? Do you mind?
So, whatever you want.
So, Chair, with regards to items PH1 and 2, I'd like to move them together for approval together with staff's recommendation.
A motion has been made on PH1
and
2. And the motion is seconded. Is there any discussion on PH1 and 2? Hearing none. Any from the public? Seeing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
PH1 and 2 are approved unanimously.
Before we go to PH3, I'll go to PH4 since there's no speakers on that item.
Okay.
Item PH4 is the update of your council's rules of procedure. The committee members are very aware of this item that was initiated in January to do a thorough review and update of your rules of procedure. The combined committees recommended approval of what you see before you, which included a couple of extra things from what staff had brought forward to them at the May meeting. I just want to give you a couple of the highlights of things to note in the rules, and we are going to send you a clean copy of this if it is adopted today, so you will have a clean copy to keep with you always for your rules of procedure. The highlights really, like I said, are streamlining.
Yeah.
It's a good time. Streamlining the redundant committee structure to a single committee from eliminating the Land Use Traffic Waste Committee, really just combining that with the executive committee structure during the in the rules of procedure. Maintaining the time limits and adding language that the chair may permit the waiving of time to another speaker, with the addition that once someone waives their time, it's irrevocable. So if someone has waived their time to a speaker, that they're not able to come forward and say, well, I don't like what the speaker said and I want to add this to it. So it's irrevocable once you've waived your time. But also updates the excuse absence request language to be reflective of the county rules, with the addition of two things. Clarifying an absence can be for an official government. If you're an elected official and you have something that you need to attend to at the city or school board, that can be an excuse absence request. And then also adding in that once a year you're able to ask for a personal reason such as vacation. So it just clarifies that list, but the list is reflective of what the county's rules are in general. Also streamlines the public hearing references for public hearing references in general, and also the quasi-judicial hearings. We had Andy, he did a great job on revising the quasi-judicial requirements for greater consistency with the county commission rules. And then I think the remainder of the modifications can just be stated that they were focused on streamlining, eliminating, modernizing the content and intent of the rules of procedure. As I said, the combined committees made a recommendation of approval at their May committee meeting, and staff is fully supportive of that.
I want to thank staff for all their work on this item. It's not an easy item to write rules for a committee. I serve on the committee that reviewed these rules, as do several of us, and we found it very much in order, and I think that it'll be good for the council. Do I have a motion on PH4?
Second. I'll move PH4.
Second.
Moved by Senator Rich, seconded by Mayor Brunson. Is there any discussion on PH4? Seeing none, any from the
Commissioner?
Public? Yes.
Commissioner, I just wanted to echo your words. I just want to thank staff and Barb for doing a fantastic job with this. They listened to us at the committee meetings and took the appropriate action. They really, since January, have done a really, really great job working together to get something that's usable and easily definable. So thank you again, Barb, and your team.
I also want to thank you, Mr. DiGiorgio, for your leadership as chair of this committee. It is a great item, and I want to thank you for it as well. Is there any comment from the public on PH4? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Is there any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. PH3.
Thank you. So as I said, and thank you so much, our staff did a great job. Andy and Deanne did a wonderful job. So thank you to everyone. And like I said, we'll send out a clean copy to you for you to have so you can read your rules. So thanks for all the support. The final item on the public hearing agenda is item PH3. And just a little bit to take us back to last year. Last year, the Planning Council had basically initiated any incentive-based policies or permitted uses to be brought forward to the council. And one of the proposals that staff made and that the council was fully supportive of was adding to the permitted uses of the community permitted use an affordable housing component. And it was for accessory uses to any primary community facilities use. There was a lot of discussion at the county commission when it went to them in the fall for transmittal to the state. There was not enough votes in favor of transmitting it, but they did us the favor of sending it back to the Planning Council for reconsideration. The item that you have before you has been reformulated. It's a similar concept, but it's more restrictive in a few ways. And I just would like to go through the highlights of the proposed amendment. And that is that this is an incentive-based policy. It's structured similar to policies 2.16.3 regarding bonus density, as well as 2.16.4 regarding affordable housing and commerce designated or activity center designated lands. So it's brought forward to you as an incentive-based policy as opposed to a permitted use. It is also structured to be restricted to west of and including US 1, similar to policy 2.16.4 with that restriction. It is now for publicly owned lands by a municipality within their own jurisdiction or county commission owned lands or school board owned lands. And the thought process behind that is that this would be the first phase of the incentive, see if it's successful, and see if there's an appetite to move it forward and to expand to privately held community designated lands. So it's a limitation, but with an idea that it could be expanded in the future to include all of those lands. At least 25% of the dwelling units would be required to be deed restricted as moderate, low, or very low affordable housing for a period of at least 30 years. Again, replicating the language in 2.16.3 and 2.16.4. The maximum density cannot exceed 50 dwelling units per acre. That doesn't mean that every development would be 50 dwelling units per acre, but the maximum density cannot exceed that. And there's a couple of things with that. One is that some of these properties are along arterials, but many of them are in residential areas. So obviously, local governments would want to be able to control compatibility. Compatibility is also a requirement of the policy, the determination of that. We replicated the language from 2.16.3 that determination would need to be made at a public hearing, at a publicly noticed meeting to replicate. That was one of the discussion points that was brought up at the county commission. And the governing body must always find a sufficient facilities and services are available to serve the proposed land use. As I said, this shift to in the incentive-based policy is to really limit it at first and see if there's an appetite and see if there's success that it could be expanded in the future. So it's structured that it could be expanded or it's structured that it could remain the same, depending on that. Planning Council staff recommends approval of the proposed text amendment. I will also say that attachment 6 of your backup materials were comments that were received from local governments. We received comments from unincorporated Broward County, the City of Fort Lauderdale, and the City of Hollywood. And we were able to address many of the comments. There's a couple comments that I'd like to take some more time, if it's transmitted by the County Commission, to examine and see if it could be worked into the policy. But with that, we recommend approval in the form that you see in Attachment 1. There is one public speaker signed in, Carter McDowell.
Okay, I will ask for a motion in a second before we entertain the public. Is there a motion on PH3? There's a motion by Mayor Hardin, seconded by Mayor Brunson. Sir, do you wish to come forward? Your name, address, and affiliation for the record, please.
Good morning. Good morning. For the record, my name is Carter McDowell with Bills and Sundberg. My office is at 1450 Brickell Avenue in Miami. I'm here. I represent an entity called PRH 1301, and we are currently working with the City of Hollywood on a P3 project, but my comments are more really not directed to that project, directed more generically to P3 projects. My firm does a lot of work in the P3 area. We've worked with Miami-Dade County and other private parties, and through the P3 process, we've actually created literally thousands of affordable housing units through P3 projects with local governments. It is an opportunity. Government often has significant underutilized properties or surplus properties, and it's a real opportunity. We're here supporting the policy with one small exception, and I call it small. Your staff disagrees with me, so you'll have to make that decision. The policy starts off with within parcels located west of and including US 1 designated community on the Broward County land use, dwelling units may be permitted subject to the following. Our suggestion to the public sector is you already have incentives for the private sector and density bonuses for the private sector countywide, all the way to the ocean. There's no exclusion of the area west, just to the west of Broward County. There is a policy in your plan, which this new policy is based on, which is 16.2.16.4, that does have that limitation in it, but this is for publicly owned land. Why would you not allow the public the same potential opportunity as the private sector has under your policies in 16.2.16.3, where it applies countywide? And so we would suggest, and I can give you handouts that the words located west of and including US-1, including US-1 and designated, that those lines be removed to give the public sector the largest opportunity to consider P3 projects that might provide additional affordable housing throughout the county. That's a simple request. It's a recommendation. I think from a policy standpoint, it makes a lot of sense for the public sector to have at least the same opportunities as the private. And with that, we ask that you consider that change. If you'd like to see it, I can give you a copy.
If you could hand that to the clerk, it'll be part of the record, and I thank you for your testimony. The item's been moved and seconded. Are there any other speakers?
Mr. Chair.
There's no other speakers.
Sorry?
There are no other speakers from the public.
Mayor Levy.
Senator Rich.
Senator Rich. First.
Okay, thank you. So as you described all of this, I want to know if this includes the implications that we have from the Live Local Act with regard to municipalities and the way affordable housing developments would be approved.
The Live Local Act does not address community designated lands. That's for commercial and industrial designated lands primarily. Yeah, that's where the we'll call it incentive is based for those. So these are not subject to the height density exclusions or inclusions that Live Local has. So this would be structured strictly in the Broward County land use plan.
Okay. And the other question is that I happen to support the way it is right now and with regard to properties west of US 1. Could you explain your position on this and why you believe that's the
proper
way?
Absolutely. Thank you. As I said during the overview, the structure of that, really the genesis, was from 2.16.4, which is the Commerce and Activity Center policy that was adopted in 2021 and then updated the end of 2022. A couple of things that are different, I find, about the community land use. One is staff's position is that we are here, if we're creating new policy, a protection of the barrier island. You know, that's staff's position. And, you know, whether you agree or disagree with that, that's staff's position. It's a new policy. What's the best thing that we can do for the county moving forward to that and have a protection of the barrier island? But also the community land use is a little bit different because it doesn't permit residential now. Residential obviously permits residential. Commerce permits residential by the allocation of flexibility units or if there's an affordable housing component subject to policy 2.16.4. So I think staff's position is that as we, you know, look forward on the plan, you know, what's the best that we can do for the county protecting the barrier island and, you know, taking that position from staff's perspective. So that's basically staff's position.
And I just would like to comment that I support that position. I'm sorry that Dr. Harada's not here today to explain why that's really the more the proper decision to make and that we need to protect those lands east of US 1 and particularly the barrier islands. So and the continued climate change implications here with sea level rise and saltwater intrusion and all these things that we know are happening. So I still maintain that that's the proper policy. Thank you.
Mayor Levy.
So, you know, the discussion is about, of course, community property and the limitation here being only west of US 1 to provide this incentive to have a municipality be able to entertain the idea of providing for a different community necessity, which is also affordable housing. Community property, Barbara, could be school board property, it could be county-owned property, it could be municipally-owned property.
In this first form, right. And
right.
There's many privately held community designated lands that are held by churches, schools, the Archdiocese, mm-hmm. which is a church, obviously.
Right. So I know that with the limitation of available property and with the endeavor to try to find places for affordable housing for those cities along the East Coast that do, you know, embrace additional affordable housing like Hollywood, like Pompano. I think we like to have the opportunity to weigh, you know, decisions on a property-by-property basis on where we might think as a community it might be befitting the city to have affordable housing. We don't regard affordable housing as a stain. And so I support the policy here because it does provide municipalities with the opportunity to entertain this on community property. Now, the limitation west of US 1, you know, US 1 for Hollywood is a pretty wanting corridor. It still looks, a lot of it still looks like the 1970s, the 1960s US 1, unfortunately, I have to say. In and around our young circle, that's different, but north and south, it's still, you know, still got motels from the 1950s that aren't too great. And so this would in effect, Barbara, for example, not to say that there, I don't think we have, honestly, community property that's just east of US 1. And so it begs the question of what community property really is there to create an opportunity, or are we just, you know, cutting this off not without reference to, and not, without consideration to potential opportunities that might exist along the east side of, say, of US 1. I don't know, Mayor Hardin, if the east side of US 1 in Pompano does have community property that you all were looking at possibly, you know, wanting to see contribute in a different way. Barbara, you had mentioned that you did have like an inventory of the very limited amount of community properties that exist in this east of US 1. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for asking that question. I have a secret map that's right here. But really, the case was it was hard to pull the data, so it's not something I really wanted to publish, you know, at this point. But east of Federal Highway, there's a handful of properties. I'm just counting quickly, there's 14 or 15 east of US 1.
Does that include schools?
That includes anything that's owned by a municipality, the school board, or county commission in this case. But if it was every community use, I didn't bring a copy of that map because that's just there's a lot of properties with that.
So say, for example, if the school district had a surplus property east of US 1, which I imagine that they may in the future because I've heard discussions about the school district looking at right-sizing its operations. Would this deprive you know, that potential opportunity for the school district to try to, you know, provide for a community in need of affordable housing and a future use of a property. Maybe it could be a affordable housing slash community education facility that through a P3 could, you know, develop itself, you know, not being on the public dime. Do you feel like that could be limiting? In other words, maybe the language doesn't need to extend all the way to east of the intercoastal, but maybe there are those 14 properties and maybe some of them are potential candidates.
So what I would say about the school properties, my recollection is there were at least two, maybe three school board owned properties that include existing schools that are east of US 1. If there was going to be a modification to the policy from staff's perspective, I would say keep it in line with 2.16.4, which is west of the intercoastal waterway and only if the local government determines that it's appropriate. So I would, you know, that could be a consideration for expansion. That expansion to that policy came up through the public hearing process. That wasn't in the original kind of context. So if there's a policy, if there's a will for that, my staff's recommendation would be west of the intercoastal waterway at the determination, you know, to mirror the language, sorry, from 2.16.4.
Yeah. So I like that, west of the intercoastal, subject to, you know, the local government approval. I think that does leave the door open for the school district primarily, because I think you're the big property owner for community uses on the public side, probably on the, you know, between that intercoastal and US 1. Last thing I'll say, though, with regards to the barrier island, I just want people to understand that, of course, we have a lot of low-wage income earners that work in our hospitality industry in Broward County, and the hotels and the business places that they work by the thousands of them are the barrier islands. And you know, to use the word barrier island, that's of course like a you know, ecological term, brings by good feelings. But our beaches are the most dense parts of our county. They have, you know, thousands of people who enjoy living there, thousands more who would love to live there. And until they're forced out, you know, by a ocean that won't stop, you know, they're going to still want to live there. And before they are willing to move there, they're going to expect us to put seawalls and protect their way of life and the tens of billions of dollars of real estate that's there, that we're not, you know, retreating anytime soon as a society, you know, because people live there and they own private property. So my point is that let's keep in mind that I don't want to necessarily close the door to affordable housing in general, affordable opportunities next to those workplaces where people work. So if you live in a hotel, actually, if you work in a hotel and you make, you know, $14, $15 an hour, right now you're forced to jump on a bus and take 2 hours to get to your house, say, in Lauderhill is one of the, or Lauderdale Lakes is or one of the two cities that we have a lot of hotel employees that work in Hollywood. We did a study to try to help with Broward County Transit and, you know, try to save them from having to take a two-hour trip to get to their workplace on the barrier island. So what if they had, you know, a living opportunity, you know, within walking distance of the hotel that they work in? That would be necessitate to be affordable or workforce housing. And so I don't think that affordable housing, even on the sexy beaches of Broward County, is a bad thing. Now, I know the discussion here is about community-owned property, and maybe what the policy that, you know, Barbara is suggesting is we want to draw the line and not necessarily make community property on the beaches to be where we can have affordable housing. But it doesn't close the door for affordable housing opportunity on commercially zoned or residentially zoned property on the barrier island. So I just want to just state that I think as a category it's okay to have moderate and affordable housing even on the beaches. But this, Barbara, you'll confirm, doesn't close the door, obviously, for the opportunities on property other than community.
Mayor Harden.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I was going to suggest something similar to what Mayor Levy is talking about, although I have a little different feeling about it. Part of the reason in my mind for the demarcation of the barrier island versus the rest of South Florida is also, it's not just is not to try and keep people, you know, poor people out. It's just because of the number of people. If some developer were to come forward and say, listen, I want to build an affordable housing complex here on Pompano Beach, on the beach, will you give me extra units for it? I'd have to say no, because in my mind that would be basic. I mean, I kind of know what they'd be doing. They'd be building it in hopes that eventually they'd be able to convert it to some other type of residential. And some developers, they've got deep enough pockets, they could actually do that. And I expect they probably would. But I do think that we should mirror what we did with the Geller Amendment, for lack of a better term. That would allow flexibility up to the intracoastal. I was the one that actually brought that up with Commissioner or Senator Geller. But it's at the option of the local municipality. So it has to be requested by and approved by the local municipality. That way we still keep local control for our local situation. Going up to the intercoastal, but not over. That would be my feelings. Yes. Yep. Thank you.
School Board Member Zeman.
Thank you so much, Acting Chair Castillo. We have been actively talking about repurposing schools. Our estimates are on the tune of 40 or so schools countywide, where we have more schools than students. And even with the greatest demand coming for demographic shifts in Broward over the next 10 or 20 years, it's not likely we're going to need more than 200. And so coming down 40 does make great fiscal sense. And more importantly, it allows the school board to work with the municipalities, to work with organizations like this and the county commission to reimagine what that land could do. And as the largest landowner in Broward County, I think that that's something that we have to think a little bit about as we move forward. To my knowledge, there's a number of more than two or three of schools east of US 1, having lived there for a few decades. I could name some of them. But I like the flexibility of P3. I like the flexibility of getting municipal support for anything that we do. I love the idea of having planners help us imagine what needs to be done with that property and adjacent properties so that we can do things that are actually great in the ideal model of city planning. So I would just in general be in favor with a line at the intercoastal, but for different reasons. As an economist, I'll tell you that building affordable housing on land where it's $1 million a quarter acre probably isn't the ideal way to get the scale we need. And we need scale. I mean, we really need scale for workforce housing and for affordable housing. In fact, I view everything I do on this council and even what I do with the real estate people at Broward County through the lens of how are we going to create a market failure that we've had for multiple decades here of not building for a diverse community in terms of income for where they can afford to live. And at the same time, not providing the kind of salary enhancements through federal and state rules that would allow them to afford those things. So in some senses, we haven't done much on minimum wage and working wages. Unions membership have gone down by a factor of 3 over the last 25 years, and wages have been stagnant in the country. But our cost of housing has just continued to go to staggering growth rates. And so we find ourselves in this really odd place where, you know, the market has not really reacted to what we need. And that's true because it's a sticky market. Housing is a difficult thing to change in any reasonable amount of time. And I find these 15% set-asides to be, you know, bear hunting with a buggy whip. We got to stop that, and we got to figure out how we affect things that have been approved and how we affect, master planning at cities. We have to repurpose land wherever we can, you know, to correct these things. And so I would love to still have that flexibility. I also wish I had had, more time as a new member to this council. I apologize for being prepared but not fully prepared. If I had to vote today, it would be for the intercoastal. If I had my druthers, I could table this for one more meeting and we could get some real studies of it. I can bring a list of all the public properties we have. Some of them are schools, but we also own land that are not schools. In fact, we own, don't tell anybody, we own lots of land. And, we are now looking at that. And I give credit to our school board for having the courage to do this, because none of them are going to get any votes because they repurposed a school, trust me. But all of them together, I think, are acting in what's in the best interest of the whole county rather than what's in the interest of them politically or their own particular district. So I believe that the discussion that we had on Tuesday of this week was robust and supportive of that kind of profile, you know, zero next year, five or so in 2 years, 10 in 3 years, and 15 in 4 years. That would be a right sizing of 35 schools. It would give us lots of flexibility, but it would really let us work with all the municipalities to do better in terms of affordable and workforce housing in a way that could affect thousands and thousands of people, including teachers and cafeteria workers and school bus drivers and things like that. So we're also the largest employer of Broward County, and our people have what Mayor Levy has said is that, you know, Hollywood to Lauderdale Lakes commuting problem. There's no mass transit for them. Their wages are not where we'd like them to be. And so the result of that is it's a 1 or more hour commute for them to get to our schools. So if we could table this, I'd love to come back with some new and different information about the plan that we have in Broward County Schools, a specific number of properties that we have east of US 1. If we had to vote today, I would do it at the Intercoastal, just because I think that that's a better demarcation. And I like Barbara's point about the municipals would have to approve it, right? The school board obviously would have to approve any of those kinds of changes. Those are some pretty high hurdles to get over right there. To do anything that approaches the restrictions here in number three. Thank you, ma'am.
Before entertaining any motions, I want to make sure that we get everyone to speak. So, Commissioner Raley is next.
Thank you. Being the rookie, I do have a couple of questions. I'm sorry, I need clarification. I think the policy should be consistent across the board. We have a demarcation now. But does that mean if a private sector comes in and wants to build housing, that they can? So I'm not fully understanding the difference if we wanted to bring affordable housing to that area as opposed to a private sector coming in and building. So I just need clarification on that. And I think that municipalities should have the authority across the board determining housing in their cities.
Ms. Blickboy, do you have any response to that?
If I'm understanding, your question was about the privately held lands? Or
no, about P3 with the demarcation.
Demarcation, the privately held lands, so this policy is, sorry, I misunderstood that, not applicable right now to privately held lands. The demarcation right now under bonus density 2.16.3, there is no demarcation. But those are lands that are already designated residential on the county plan and already permit residential. So it doesn't prohibit bonus density there. Policy 2.16.4, as I said, commerce lands allow residential by right if there's the affordable housing component under 2.16.4 or in the permitted uses by the allocations of flexibility. I don't see it as... I don't see it in conflict. I don't object to the expansion to the Intracoastal Waterway West and under the by determination of the local government. But like I said, I would object right now to the expansion beyond the Intracoastal Waterway for the protection of the barrier island.
I see. Council Member Harland has her hand raised.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There have been many terrific points made today, so I don't want to be redundant, but as a municipal elected, my other hat, and I understand where Commissioner Raley is coming from, we never want to see our local decision-making affected, but we have to make this decision as this body, and it's incumbent upon us to make decisions that protect the entire county. So I'm in complete support of Ms. Blakeboy and staff's position. I would be amenable to moving that line to the Intercoastal, but we have a very delicate balance, and I almost wish our workshop, our July workshop with Ms. Dr. Hirado, had come before this item, and I think perhaps that could better inform the decision, but I think we have to protect those barrier islands as a planning council as best we can. So I just wanted to weigh in on that, and I thank everybody for their very thoughtful comments.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I see some that want a second round. Senator Rich?
I just want to mention that, first of all, the whole issue with the transit corridors is just beginning to get underway. We have not really implemented that the way we had hoped. It's taking longer. So we have a lot of land and a lot of areas that we can use along the transit corridors, which would be west of US 1. That's number one. The second thing is with regard to the schools. I know that we've been talking with the school board for quite some time about using land, and Ralph Stone, our housing finance director, has been doing that, and nothing has happened yet. So I'm happy to hear that there is movement here. But I just do want to say that there are many school properties that are west of US 1, and I think, you know, there's a lot of work to be done before anybody would consider looking east of US 1, as far as I'm concerned, for this. And, you know, someone said something, we're not retreating. Well, we will retreat at some time, because we cannot sustain what's going on with regard to climate change. I mean, we see it every day, and we know what's happening. And for us to go ahead and make this, I don't see it as two different standards. I see it as us looking at a countywide issue all along the coastal areas and not exacerbating a problem that already exists. And I think that we need to stick with that. If something comes up along the way and you know, some other thing comes to us where we can prove that that's not going to be the impact here, that's another story. But I think right now we know it. And we have to have a balance. I am certainly probably the number one advocate on the commission for affordable housing. And everything that's been said is true about the needs. But we also have to balance it with our environment and what is happening there. And so that's why I strongly oppose changing this.
Mayor Levy, did you have an additional comment?
No, just to close it out, I mean, there seems to be support from a number of board members, including myself, for the west of the intercoastal subject to municipal approval. I'd like to offer that as an amendment to the motion.
Second.
A motion has been made to amend, which is seconded. Any additional discussion on the motion? School Board Member Zeman.
Thank you so much, Acting Chair. I'd like to ask Senator Rich to help me a little bit more understand this difference. In particular, where there is P3s that do workforce or affordable housing between US 1 and the Intercoastal, help me understand kind of how that is different than the environmental impact of doing the same thing on private land in that same area, or putting a government facility or doing single-family housing development or doing some kind of commercial development on that same land. I'm trying to understand kind of the overlap between the climate change issue, which is very real and present to us, and the use of some community-based land. If, in fact, the municipality agreed to it and the school board agreed to the plan and it was done, you know, on community property to deal with this current crisis on housing distribution, how is that development any different than the development on that land of selling it and it becoming a commercial property and they can do whatever they want with it or whatever the city will allow them to do it, versus doing some other kind of commercial development or single-family home development? I'm trying to just understand more about that, because the effect on the Barrier Island is very easy to understand. When I think about Broward County and that ribbon between the Intercoastal and US 1, there's a lot of variance there. It's not all like it is in Fort Lauderdale, where it's, you know, virtually 100% single-family homes plus commercial. What it is in Pompano, what it is in Deerfield Beach, what it is in Hollywood and Hallidale is very different than it is in the central part of the county. But I'm just trying to understand more, given your vast experience in this area.
Say, Rich.
Thank you. I think I'll defer some of that to Ms. Blakeboy, but I think she's already mentioned some of it. But to me, the bottom line is, why do we want to exacerbate something? Why do we want to, you know, create a problem or exacerbate the problem that already exists by allowing this now to be available for community lands like this? To me, I just don't I don't think there's a necessity to do that. I think we have land. We don't have a lot of land in this community, that's for sure. But we have land all around the county. We have schools. We have churches. We're working right now with churches for dealing with homeless issues to do some building. They're all east. They're all west of US 1. I'm not saying, it's just because of the fact that we know we have so much of a problem with regard to environmental issues. And that's why I said I just really would prefer if we would not change this, if people want to still talk about it and get more information, I would like to wait and have Dr. Hirado make a presentation to us. She is the expert on this. And I just don't see us. And, it's interesting, because they say, well, you want a public hearing and you want to do what the people want. Well, a lot of times, the municipalities will decide to do something that the people don't want. And because they're more environmentally conscious sometimes than the commissions, I'm sorry to say, but that's the way it is. And I just feel very strongly that we should not be doing anything that, causes more harm from areas that ultimately we will have to retreat. I look at Key West, and all the way up the coast, you are dealing with these issues, and people are trying to prevent. In Dade County, you are not seeing that building going on east of. Everything is along the transportation corridor. If you drive down US 1, it's packed with affordable housing, not only affordable housing, also housing. Actual cities are developing right underneath the rail track, the tracks. I was down there the other day because I grew up down there, and your just eyes pop with what's going on. And we can do that here too. We don't need to go east of US 1 to do that.
School board member Zeman, reclaiming your time.
Oh, thank you very much, and I appreciate that extra education. My inclination is still on the intercoastal as the best demarcation line, only because municipalities and the school board or any other owner of the community land would have to agree to any kind of planning through there. And this is a balancing between the need for a distribution and better distribution of property and any potential effects of global warming and the environmental impact. But there's a huge environmental impact when we put a commercial building there. There's a huge environmental impact when we put a 40-story condominium there, many of which are going in that corridor. So I would do that. I would favor holding off on this until we hear next month from Dr. Arado, just so that we can make sure we're doing this right. And I guess my only question to the chair is, what's the urgency of doing this today?
Ms. Blake Boy, what is the urgency of doing this today?
There's no urgency in doing this today. It can certainly carry over to your August meeting. I do want to just put this out there that this is a very small number of lands that we're talking about. It's between 12 and 15 that are actually east of Federal Highway. So I just want to let you know that. So when this comes back in August, it may be the same discussion amongst you, because there's not going to be a lot that we're going to be able to change from the ownership perspective of the municipal within jurisdiction, the county commission, and the school board owned properties that are actually east of the Intracoastal Waterway.
Dynamite, given the lack of urgency, I would move to table this item until August, and so we can hear from Dr. Hirado and for some of us new members to do a little bit more research. And I'd like to get more information, because I think it may be 12 to 15 of certain kinds of properties, but if I thought about community properties east of US 1, I can count.
Right, but this is just municipal ownership, county commission ownership, and school board ownership that are designated community use on the Broward County land use plan.
Right.
So there may be other properties that are owned by those entities that are east of US 1, but they are probably not designated community use, which this is the applicability of this incentive only. So it's very narrow.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'd still motion to table this.
There's a motion and a second, a motion to defer under Robert's rules, period. Any other motion? Councilmember Harland, I see your hand is still up. Was that from the last time, or are you done?
I apologize. I didn't realize it was still up.
No, I just wanted to make sure that we were clear. There's a motion to table until when?
August?
August 24th.
Until the August meeting, and that will allow Dr. Hirado, I believe, to deliver her.
Well, you're going to have your workshop July 27th?
That's correct, July.
Is that okay?
We'll make a motion to defer to that date so that it doesn't have to be taken off the table at the hearing.
Everyone's clear on the motion. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else to say? That actually, it's not debatable, but...
No debate.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye. Yes. No.
With one. No. Who voted no?
Mayor Gomez.
Mayor Gomez voted no.
Yeah. Tommy DiGiorgio did also.
Okay. Please.
So did Denise Horland.
So did Denise Horland. The no's are catching up.
Uh-oh.
I don't think we need a roll call. I think that's clear. You have those recorded, Madam Clerk? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just a quick comment. I just want to emphasize and not let it get lost in the conversation that there could be among those 12 to 15 properties, and I have no idea where they are or what city they're in, that, for example, are...
They're not in Pembroke Pines.
They could be schools. What I'm imagining is an old school that has facilities that were built, say, you know, a long time ago, that might be substandard to what the new schools out west in Pembroke Pines and beyond look like. And that already constructed property with a bunch of asphalt parking lots and inefficient buildings ought to be something newer than it is today. To today's standards, today's green building standards, and today's mix of uses opportunities where you could have educational facilities together with multifamily housing on that property, for example. And so my desire is to not shut the door on those opportunities for already developed publicly owned property to be to evolve to serve the community and its needs in the future. So I just wanted to point out that the references to existing built government property.
Thank you, Mayor, for that comment. We're ready to move on to the next item.
Thank you. The next item is item R1. This is a presentation by the school board staff and its consultant. I believe Chris Acabuso from school board staff is going to introduce the item.
Acabuso, our good friend.
And just a point of order for my colleagues, this has been passed out to you separately from the binder.
On the dais. Your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Good morning, council members. Commissioner Castillo.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Haven't seen you in years.
Yes.
Totally appreciate the opportunity to be here. Haven't been here in a long time. So this project.
Your name for the record, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chris Akabusu, Director, Facility Plan and Real Estate.
Brown County School.
Good notes.
Brown County School Board. Okay,
yes.
Go right ahead.
So this project represents the ongoing collaboration. The school board has been a participant in development review in Brown County. The school board, talking about affordable housing, has been, you know, enabling impact fee waivers since 1987. So we all saw part of that process. So this study is the student generation rate is the multiplier that the school board uses to determine how many students are going to come from development or review. And then the impact fee, as you know, is pretty much to address, you know, the impact of proposed residential development. The study is required by the, what we call the trialer, which pretty much stands for the third and amended and reinstated interlocal agreement for public school facility planning. And the reason is it's been amended three times. So that study requires for this study to, the trialer requires for the study to be done at least once every 3 years. So this is that 3-year cycle. The last study was done in 2019. The school board, pretty much the trialer, and then school board policy also, you know, praise the call for it, for the study to be done by the school board in coordination with Broward County and then the municipalities. So it's a collaborative effort. The staff working group, which pretty much supports the oversight committee, we have a standing committee that's involved with the study from day one. So I just wanted to point out it's a collaboration. So Broward County School Board transferred the study to the County Commission in August of 2019. It became effective. The study recommendation from that study became effective in October in 2020. So the study cycle again has started. So we started the process. School Board normally puts out an RFP. The RFP was done in 2022. There were some respondents, and Benesh, who's the company today, who's before you, the consultant to present, was the outcome of that bid. The school board went into contract with Benesh on October 22, 2022. So this is part of that iteration of the study. As part of that contract, there's a bunch of timelines, including presentation before different bodies. The presentation has been also given thus far to the League of Cities. They're also part of this process. We normally, I think after this, the public, which is the developers, are also going to be presented to you know, be able to provide comments. So it's a collaboration and also enabling every, you know, potential body that's going to be impacted to comment and be able to make comments. So today we're before you, and I totally appreciate it. As part of the timeline, we're going to be coming back to the Planning Council sometime in the fall, where you do the local planning agency process. So today is just a presentation in terms of where we are. So I have Ms. Nielgen Camp here, who's the lead person, and thank you so much.
Your name and affiliation for the record, please.
Good morning. Nielgen Camp with Benesh. So the presentation gives a little bit an overview and background, and then, again, this is an interim presentation, kind of sharing with you where we are today. So we don't have all the results, just to give you an update where we are. I think Chris covered it, but TILA requires that the student generation rate studies be updated every 3 years, and then the other impact variables are also updated as part of that effort.
If I may interrupt you for a second. So we have a document in front of us. Are you following this document, or is this supplemental to your
The slides. That's what I'm
on. All right.
Yes,
so
I'm
where are you now?
Three.
Which you're on slide three. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Okay. So slide four, impact fees, as you know, are one-time capital charge to new development. They cover the cost of new capital facilities. And although they cannot be directly spent for maintenance and renovations, they free up general tax dollars for those expenses. Their goal is to help implement the capital plans, and school impact fees are collected only from residential land uses. Typically, schools and transportation are the two most expensive capital infrastructure that local governments provide, and the impact fees sort of reflect that at their rate. And then because school impact fees are only charged to residential development, that's one of the reasons they tend to be so high. The study is using a consumption-based methodology, which is very common in Florida, and it's also your adopted methodology. It has been like that for a long time. It charges new growth based on the value of the school infrastructure capacity it's using. And fees are calculated at a level that they don't generate sufficient revenues to cover any existing deficiencies, and that's one of the legal requirements, that new development should not be charged for existing deficiencies. Basic impact fee formula looks at cost to provide school infrastructure, so that's the value of the school buildings primarily, and it reviews how the school district is funding capacity projects, and to the extent that millage or other revenue sources are being used, a portion will come from future development. So that is subtracted to make sure that we are not charging them once through the impact fee and once through the tax. And that net cost gets multiplied by demand, and that's the student generation rate, number of students per residential unit. This is the current fee schedule, and as you can see, there are really about 12 categories. Some of the uses of impact fees is adding wings, classroom additions, new additional buses, equipment, debt service payments for debt that was used to build capacity historically. And then legal requirements for many years in Florida, impact fees were governed by case law, and in about 2006, we had the Impact Fee Act pass, and then it's been revised over time. But some of the key requirements that the fees be based on most recent and localized data, there's at least a minimum of 90-day notice period required for any fee increases. And then if there's any challenge to the fee, the local government has the burden of showing that their fees are correct. And there are some other requirements as well. In 2019, House Bill 7103 allowed local governments to waive and reduce impact fees for affordable workforce housing without having to offset. So typically, impact fees cannot be reduced for a specific land use. It can be reduced for all of the categories in the fee schedule equally, just to protect equity between land uses. But that was made an exception that they could waive and reduce for affordable workforce housing. And at the same time, it also required indexing of any developer credits when the fees increase. Then in 2021, we had House Bill 337 passed. That's after your last study. So it put limits on fee increases. It said if the increase is up to 25%, it has to be done over 2 years. If it is up to 50%, it has to be done over 4 installments. And it cannot be increased more than 50% without showing extraordinary circumstances. So there's an exception clause. Also, fees cannot be increased more than once every 4 years. So since the Broward County school impact fee was, the increase was implemented in 22, any increases cannot be implemented until 26. If the fees are decreasing for some categories, that can be implemented right away. And again, the study, recent legislation has an exception that if the local government shows that there are extraordinary circumstances that require more than 50% increase, and those are discussed publicly in 2 public workshops, and a 2/3 of the governing body votes for them, it can be above 50%. So this is the study schedule. We started the study back in December. And today we are just sharing some of the preliminary interim results. I think this is still, the rest of the schedule is still being worked on, but I think our next step is complete the study and then go through, come back to you in the fall with the full study and the full results. So just to start with some framework for Broward County. Obviously, Broward County is the second largest out of 67 Florida counties in population, and is still growing, 37th in projected population growth, 6th in absolute growth. That, of course, relates that the base is so large. And then 25th in student generation rate. So it's in the top half in all students, not just traditional students. And then student generation study looks at several variables to estimate the generation rates. So this chart is showing the trends in enrollment. And again, this is all schools, not just traditional, but it's also charter public schools, all students since 1980s per housing unit. So student enrollment per housing unit. Blue line is Florida and the orange line is Broward County. And you can see that the student enrollment since 2000 is decreasing in Broward County and remain about the same between 2010 and 2020, but Florida is decreasing at a faster rate. So Broward County used to be below Florida average and now is above, even though it is also experiencing somewhat of a decrease. This chart is showing age distribution as the older communities have fewer students. And again, blue bars is Florida and orange is Broward County, and Broward County is exceeding Florida's average in the some of the younger groups, as well as all the way to 64 and so. This chart is showing median age trends, and this is similar to enrollment trends that even though median age is increasing in the county, it's not increasing as rapidly as statewide average. So it's a slower increase. We look at vacancy trends. If there are a lot of significant vacancy, the generation rates tend to be lower. But you can see that these are hovering around 6 to 8%, so it's not a period of significant vacancy. And then similarly, seasonal homes, if there are a significant amount of seasonal homes in a community, generation rates, again, tend to be lower. So here there's a little bit of an increase, but then again, just the percentage-wise, it's only about 8% of homes are about seasonal homes. This chart showing permitting trends going back to 2000. During the last study, that the period that we study in terms of the new homes, there were about 4,000 new permits per year. And now, last 5 years, it's about 4,400, so about 10% greater. And a significant portion of those are multifamily, as expected. This chart is important for two reasons. One is it's showing the development trends since 80s, and you can see 80s and 90s all the way to 2000, there was a lot of growth. A lot of units were being built, and that's one of the reasons, like, there were more schools, a lot of schools were being built in anticipation of this growth continuing. And then we got into the recessions around 2010 or so, that growth decreased significantly. But those schools still have debt service on them that needs to be paid. The other reason that this chart is helpful is school districts' methodology until the last study to estimate the student generation rates was to review the recent housing trends. It was only based on new homes. And in the past, there were more bigger samples. And then as we got into the recession, that sample decreased, and that's why we made some changes in the methodology last time around that I'll go through it in a minute. The student generation study, as well as the impact fee, is only including the traditional students that the school district is responsible for, and they make up about 80% of all students. The other 20% includes charter schools and the private schools or any other type of class. This is showing the enrollment trends for traditional students, and you can see, this is going back to 2010, you can see overall like a decrease and some years slight increase, about 1 to 2% range. And then during the pandemic, there was a significant decrease of about 4%. That was pretty common. Pretty much every school district experienced that. And then it kind of moderated back to about 1 or 2% changes. And here you see the enrollment of charter to traditional schools. Charter schools are accommodating more and more students in Broward County. In about 2010, it was about 9% of traditional schools, now it's about 25%. And this is showing the charter school added over time. So between 2012 and 2014, they added about 4,800 students per year, the charter schools. 2015 to 2017, that decreased to 2,600. 2018 to 2023 is about 700 now. So it's tapering off some, but they are providing school facilities for a good chunk of students. Student generation rate methodology that basically takes the student addresses and matches them with the property appraiser database, so then we can see what type of housing unit they are coming from. And then the resulting generation rate at the very first schedule, fee schedule you saw, it gives us students by type of residential category and also by bedroom. So historically, in 2007, 2014, the school district studies focused on new homes only. And for example, for 2014, 2006 to 2013, data was considered new and so on. So they looked at past 4 or 5 years and used the data that was there. That we also did that in 2017 during the last study. But we were running into issues of extreme fluctuations because we didn't have large enough sample for all of the 12 categories. So we were seeing increases like 400%, 800%, but it wasn't really happening in reality. It was more of a sample issue. So to supplement that, we also looked at student generation rate of all homes in the county, and which is very common for impact fee study purposes because fees are paid once for the life of the home. So, you know, that house will house a family today, maybe a retired couple down the road or somebody's newly married people. So it's going to house different families. From that perspective, that approach makes sense too. So we did add that. And then finally, working with the oversight committee, we developed a hybrid approach. So that included looking at all homes, new homes, any results of the past two studies. So basically try to achieve a large enough sample where the rates are making sense and they are more stable. So this study, we repeated that hybrid approach as well. The other change since the last study, during the last study, property appraiser database did not have bedroom data for a significant number of condos. So we were losing about 30% of them. This study, there's much better data. It's only 3% of them doesn't have that data. So that also makes us feel better about the results. So it has a lot of numbers here, but basically it's showing the previous studies and so on. But the final estimates at this point, they are still draft, but showing that there's a slight increase in some categories to up to 20% in this first group, decrease in generation rates. So it's either there's a 4% increase in garden, large garden apartments, all other categories are either remaining about the same or decreasing. And then this is the other categories. And again, you see some decreases and a slight increase in the case of mobile homes. So it's much more stable than the fluctuations we were seeing when we were just using a smaller sample of new homes. Cost component, when we estimate the cost, we look at any recent upcoming costs locally. We supplement that with statewide construction trends. We talk to architects to see what they are seeing. We look at the insurance values. And then the land is we look at any sales throughout the county from the property appraiser, not just the district, and any appraisals available. So 2017 estimated school facility cost per student station ranging from about $32,000 to $42,000, depending on the level. This study, we are seeing quite a bit increase in costs, and a big portion of that is since the pandemic. So these are different indices, not necessarily all related to schools, but just to give you a sense, looking at 2017 to 22, building the indices ranging anywhere from 20% to 70%. Florida Department of Education's student station cost index is about 23%. They use CPI as a base. So this is kind of showing that information visually.
Can you back up one slide, please?
I'm sorry?
Back up one slide.
Oh, absolutely.
Did you just say that the State Department of Education's student station cost index is based on prices of commodities?
Yes.
That's insane. I mean, I'm just going to tell you, whoever does that is, I mean, I'm an economist, right? And it's like jumps out at you like, wait a minute. The price of a student station, far more related to construction and maintenance and repair costs and all that, than it is the life of a loaf of bread and a box.
Head of lettuce.
Right? So why are they doing that?
So.
And why are we using it?
You are ahead of me. I'm going to get there in a minute, explain you the whole history on that. Is that okay? I answer you where we get there, or?
You're an autonomous human being.
Okay. So, again, here we just wanted to show you. We just wanted to show you on this chart that the fluctuations over the last 2-3 years has been significant. Okay, this is where it goes. So based on all that data, we estimated total facility costs. This is construction, design, FF&E, everything, about $460 to almost $600 per square foot, which then results in student station cost of anywhere from $61,000 to $74,000, overall weighted average $66,000. So Florida Department of Education a few years back said that school districts have to spend no more than what they publish as the school construction cost. And that cost, so at the time, they ask EDR to do a study how to determine that cost. So right now, that those costs are based on 2006 figures inflated by CPI. EDR came back, and they don't differ. It's the same cost for Broward County, Bay County, Hillsborough County, Flagler County. Basically, entire state, same exact cost. So EDR came back and said that, you know, there should be some geographical variations, and it should be per square foot because it's per station. So it's also implying everybody is building about the same size schools or same amenities. So there's a lot of implications on using per station. But then that study was put aside, never been implemented, and the district the department continues with these published figures. So that's a little bit background on that. And because there's a penalty if you do not stay within those limits, most school districts try to stay within, so we just use that figure in our impact fee study. So as you can see, it's a pretty good discount from 66 to 40,000, and which makes the fee very conservative. So that's saying the increase since the last study is only about 10%. So we have sort of a academic exercise of going through the full cost of providing it, but then it gets suppressed by that figure. Credit component, we are still working on that. We are still gathering some more data, but the goal of it is to recognize that to the extent that school district spends any non-impact fee revenues on capital facilities, a portion will come from future development, and we want to subtract that. So again, next steps is for us to complete, and this schedule is being revised as we speak, but it will be for us to complete the study once we have all the data and then go through the meetings and share with you all the final results at that point. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, I'd like to begin with certain questions. So, do you have a sense of how many more or fewer students Broward County will be generating?
So the for impact fee purposes and for study, it's sort of a snapshot in time. So we are looking at current students and what they are generating now. So as you saw, there's a decrease since the last study.
What is the order of magnitude of the decrease anticipated in the number of public school students?
So the you can see on a regular basis it's about 1 to 2% decrease a year.
And that's over what period of time?
This has been the trend since 2010. But we don't necessarily make future projections. Basically, the study looks at what's going on today, and basically backward looking, existing current conditions and recent history. So we are not making any projections for school enrollment per se. District may have them, but like the study itself doesn't.
The answer to the question is it's going to be very subjective going forward. The school board's expectation is that it will grow, not shrink. Mm-hmm. There are significant changes going on in our school system, not just a new superintendent, but significant changes in the way that we fund things and how we fund things, and an insane kind of drive toward improving the quality of everything we deliver in schools. And that will lead to students who chose to do other things to come back to schools, if other districts are a guide to what we're doing.
That's very, very helpful. My second question is, yes?
What I would like you to look at is when you get your fall enrollment for next year to take a look at that, because you're missing, I mean, we've had vouchers, you know, to a certain degree, but now we not only have vouchers for charter schools, we have vouchers for private schools,
right?
And there is no question that it's going to be an impact on our public schools. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably just see the beginning of it, but it's available to anybody at whatever income. So I mean, this is going to change enrollment numbers in the schools. So I would hope that when you look at IC, you're not coming back for an adoption and a final until well after the the next school year begins, so you should have some, possibly some enrollment figures available.
Yes, we should have the October enrollment figures at that point.
Okay.
We need to know, in order to do proper land use planning, what we're looking at in terms of the number of students, plus or minus. I'm hearing that there's a trend decrease, but there's an expectation that it's going to grow, and we need to sort of know what the projections are. The second question is, is there a projection on school closures? Will there be school closures?
That's definitely outside of the study.
That's outside the scope?
No, I think, yes, go ahead.
Chris Akabusu again. To your first question, Commissioner Castillo, just for quickness, the school board, we have on our website the enrollment projections, and those enrollment projections are for every 5 years. So if you want to access the school board website, you can get those numbers right now. But I can also provide it to Barbara if you also want that. So for enrollment projections.
That would be very helpful if you could provide it. Do you have a sense of whether the number of students is growing or decreasing?
No, I don't have a sense of that. I have to, because we have actually the demographic and enrollment planning department, and we have demographers, and that's pretty much done statistically. So I definitely will provide that to Barbara, and we will provide to the council members.
Please do. Do you have a sense of what the order of magnitude might be of school closings?
Okay, so the school board is undertaking a long-range master plan. And there's been some discussions, so any component is going to be part of that process. So at this point in time, the school board is undertaking a very comprehensive process via the long-range master plan, and so we don't have any final numbers here.
Okay. We'll start from this end this time. Commissioner Raley?
Thank you. I'm just concerned about the more charter schools that are open will impact our public schools system, since charter schools are funded by the state. And I think the more students that sign up for the charter and for the private school is definitely going to impact our percentage of enrollment for students. I'm very happy to hear that our district board of education is going to step up our quality of education in the schools and also the condition of our schools. And I think that's where we really need to concentrate if we are going to draw any of the students back to the public school system. The charter schools can pick and choose. They seem more desirable at times, but I'm hoping that we can get our students back into the public school system. Thank you.
School Board Member Zeman.
Thank you very much. We've spent a lot of time thinking at Broward County Schools about impact fees and generation rates. What you've seen today is a piece of our thinking. It does not involve decisions still to be made by the Broward County School Board, but there's other things that we need to take into account. For the past 11 years, Broward County has been a B-rated school district. And so you can talk all day about private schools and vouchers and public charter schools, by the way. Every charter school in Broward County is a public school.
Yeah.
And in many cases, they're meeting a need that couldn't have been met in the innovative way that they've done that. So they are part of our public school system. The bounce that we get from becoming an A-rated district in the near future, the bounce that we get from reallocating money to teacher salaries, the bounce that we get from population growth, which is including disproportionately more people with children than the state average. All of those things will be mixed together, but I believe that the school board will take the courageous steps. The drive, by the way, for repurposing, and I'd appreciate it if we think about that term when we talk about this. It is not closing schools, it's repurposing them.
There you go.
Is we save $2 million per school. That money goes right back into the other schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's more teachers, more guidance counselors, more mental health providers, more money for bands, music, art, and other things, which make our schools more attractive for people. Remember, we live in a marketplace, and that marketplace, as the senator has pointed out, is now different than it has been in the past, because if you are sending your child to a private school already, you can apply for these $8,000 vouchers. It's either a game changer or it's going to be something that happens and, you know, our private schools that are generally full won't get any more people. They'll just get $8,000 per kid back from the state. But the Broward County School Board, if you watch what's been going on for the last 8 months, is making calculated, rational, business-minded decisions about winning kids back and winning families back. And I think that it'll be interesting to see whether the effect of declining enrollment that might happen for vouchers isn't offset by the increase in quality when we get to an A-rated school district next year, and then continue to repurpose money on the things that parents care so much about, which is teacher quality, instruction, facilities, and the like. So this is my this is what I'm doing, and I hope we are successful, but one of the ways we'll find out we're successful if we have more people coming back. So my belief is that these numbers will, while the 4% is a pandemic one, and that was experienced, by the way, in charters and homeschooling as well. I mean, it's a dramatic change in the number of people actually enrolled in education during the pandemic. Many people took time off. And but I suspect that the trend that you see over the past, you know, 4 years minus the pandemic is the bottom of the bottom, even with vouchers, you know, 0 to 1%. But I think that those other changes that we're making in terms of quality and being able to have more money to put back in the schools that remain opening and functioning as a traditional school will, over time, bring more people back than we have right now. So we have 256,000 now. I suspect in 4 years, no doubt, we will have more than that. It's just a matter of how long does it take for these changes to be put into place, and then how long until the marketplace recognizes these changes and says, you know, public school for us might be a better option than what we're going to do otherwise. Thank you.
Very, very exciting comments, Dr. Zeman. Mayor Brunson.
So I would go back to what Vice Mayor Rich said with regard to the new legislation with private schools. It is unrealistic to think that you're not going to lose students because of that funding. And it is something that needs to be taken into account for. And not only that, but the number of students who, after they get that money, they go to a private school and it's after the FTE count and they need to come back to your public school. How is that going to affect all of these numbers and being able to serve all these students? So I think that it is a lot more that we need to look at. It's a bigger picture here because of the new legislation. And so, yes, we expect and we hope that the kids come back. But because parents are given so many options right now, and public school is one of the options, and there are so many other options, including virtual schools and things like that, all of those things need to be taken into account within this report and how it's going to affect the numbers of students coming back to school.
Mm. Thank you very much. Mayor Hardin.
Thank you. You know, planning is planning takes educated people, but part of it is kind of like prognosticating into the future. So let's hope that the school board their prognostications are correct. I certainly do, but I am concerned about the future with the recent legislation that has passed. It's a scary time for public school systems,
mm-hmm.
But I would caution. Our school system, and I understand this is, you know, we're not really talking about the subject here, but I would caution our school system when they talk about repurposing their physical components to also kind of balance their prognostications. After all, if they hope to serve a greater student population in the future, it's going to be awfully difficult if they've repurposed too many of their facilities, so they won't be able to accommodate the students that they hope will have coming back. But with that, I fully support the school system, public schools overall. But I am fearful about the future, considering the current legislation that's been passed. But we shall see, and we shall prognosticate as we have to. And thank you for that.
Thank you, Mayor. Senator Rich, did you have a comment? If you could turn your mic on, then.
There's one other thing here. Page 37, just a second, and get back to that page. Yeah. I think you you answered, I think, most of this. But, I mean, there's been a lack of a district cost differential, if you will, in every way for a number of years now. So what is the penalty to the school district if you do not abide by the
I believe it's a financial. They reduced the, and we had one district actually said, you know, they only give me $2 million a year, and I'd rather my impact fees reflect the full cost. I'm just going to use it. The other thing we know is that with this recent cost increases, more and more districts are going back to DOE saying, we can't build it within those limits. I mean, just look. So they may be more flexible about that. But
just to recommend that maybe the school district talk to some of the legislators about the cost differentials now, because we saw the same thing in affordable housing here. I mean, we had to go back the year before last when we had all the ARP money and we had 9 developments, affordable housing developments, and we had to go back and give a number of them. We came back like less than 2 months after we had passed everything, saw the construction costs, and had to give $11 million out in additional gap financing. Mm. From the county's coffers, you know. So I think that, you know, it's something, and maybe we could put it on our legislative agenda as well to, you know, see if we can't get some relief from this ridiculous formula. Thank you.
Mayor Levy.
Thank you. Well, thank you for being here and providing this interim update on this student generation and impact fee study. I know you'll come back later in the year and provide us your total findings. I just want to say that Dr. Zeman's comments are reactive to the reality of today, where we have a state legislative policy that says that the dollar figure assigned to a student by the state stays at the parent's discretion of where to go with that money. And so, therefore, the perspective is from the school district is correct to compete, to say, well, we need to be attractive to that parent who's making the decision of where to send their child to school. So I'm glad to see the entrepreneurial and competitive spirit from Dr. Zeman and from the school district. It behooves all of us to step up and compete if we want to support public schools, embrace them, talk about the good things that are happening in them. And I think parents, you know, when they see improved school facilities, and obviously the opportunity, educational curriculum opportunities and different activities that the school districts can provide like no other private school or charter school, that you'll right size and you'll retain and you'll hopefully attract more. And that behooves the school district to succeed in doing that. We certainly rely on it, as cities because, you know, even though in Hollywood there have been a lot of, charter school openings over the past decade or so, they probably filled a void that the school district for a long time, you know, didn't innovate enough, didn't renew its facilities, and people felt that the newer, charter schools suddenly became more attractive and more hopeful for them, and they sent the kids there. And some of those charter schools offer, you know, language and other themes that the public schools in the surrounding area didn't innovate towards or didn't react for, and they filled a void where perhaps the parents felt there was one. So, but now here we are, and today in reality, looking to respond to today's situation. So I just applaud the school district and looking to innovate and looking at it straightforwardly and not wishing it were different, but taking it for what it is and moving forward on how to compete. On the impact fee side of things, I just wonder, say if a new apartment complex is calculated to generate perhaps 5 new students. I'm just throwing out a number. Is the impact fee calculation today, how is it calculated towards those 5 extra students? Is it a per school facility cost per student station, like this $35,000 times those 5 students and that's it? Or is it a percentage of the value of construction? Because going forward, I think where you're going to come back for is a step in your process to approve the modification of your impact fees, so, and that's capped at that 12.5%, I think, by the state, and you can't come back till 4 years later. So given that that's where we're going with all this, what is the calculation against new development that generates potential new students. How is that calculated today?
So then you see here that the cost right now with the cap of DOE is only increasing 10%, right? And we will subtract a credit. That's the component we did not do that. But there will be a net cost, say $30,000 per student. That net cost for example, garden apartment will get multiplied by, for mid-size, 0.2 to generate the fee. So on average, each unit is generating 0.2. So you see one student every five homes.
So the 0.2 is multiplied by the cost per student, and that's how you get the dollar figure for what the property owner impact fee is.
Mm-hmm. And when you see it...
Per unit.
Per dwelling unit.
Per dwelling
so
unit.
If the apartment complex has 10 units, it's 10 times that fee.
I see.
And you see that there are some categories, the generation rate is decreasing more than that 10% increase. So if depending on what happens to the loss component, they may actually see a decrease in fees.
I see. Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much. Looking forward to the final report.
Thank you, Mayor. Members Holland, Greenberg, DiGiorgio on the phone, did you have anything to add?
I did not.
Okay.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do you have anything to add to your report, Mr. Agabuso? Or?
No, I don't.
I want to thank you for this very, very helpful presentation. We look forward to seeing you back. The conversation has been very, very helpful and very, very informative. Ms. Blake Boyd, do you have anything else?
I just want to add that as we receive draft copies of the study, that will be forwarded to you as the membership, so you will always be aware of what's happening with their study and with the draft prior to returning to you as the LPA to the County Commission for the impact fee. Because I kind of feel like there's a stopgap here. This is kind of just a presentation, but there's actual data that will be sent out to you once we receive the draft.
Is there anything else?
Not on this item.
So the next time we'll meet will be Dr. Hurado's presentation on July 27th.
Yes, virtually online. You will have a Zoom link, and that will be for the Planning Council members only, and that will be webcast and available to the public.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the whole?
I have one more thing I just want to let you know. Sorry. I do want to let you know that today, even though he asked for an excused absence, is Mr. Breslau's final meeting. He's moving into retirement, and he let Senator Geller's office know in March that this would be his final meeting. So he was looking forward to being here, and he couldn't be here. He had to ask for an excused
absence.
We
miss him very much.
But I just wanted to put that on the record. I forgot to say it earlier.
We'll miss him very much, and we thank him for his years of service to the council. He's been a wonderful colleague to work with. With that, please enjoy your summer. This meeting is adjourned.